Good morning, Saints.
Good morning.
Today's scripture is the last four verses of what is considered the end of the prologue to the book of John. And just as a reminder, I'm going to read to you from chapter 20, verse 31, the reason that John wrote the book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. Shoot, here I go. You know how I am. And I want to refresh your memory about the beginning of the book, because I think we could spend the rest of our life in John 1, just that chapter. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. And today's verses are verses 14 and 18 from chapter 1, and I'm going to read from J.B. Phillips. So the Word of God became a human being and lived among us. We saw his splendor, the splendor as of a father's only son, full of grace and truth. And it was about him that John stood up and testified, exclaiming, "Here is the one I was speaking about when I said that although he would come after me, he would always be in front of me, for he existed before I was born." Indeed, every one of us has shared in his riches. There is a grace in our lives because of his grace. For while the law was given by Moses, love and truth came through Jesus Christ. It is true that no one has ever seen God at any time, yet the divine and only Son, who lives in the closest intimacy with the Father, has made him known. The word of the Lord.
Good morning, everybody. So we gather together this morning, as on any Sunday, with all kinds of problems. I mean, life is complicated, and there are a lot of us, so there are a lot of problems in the room. But we all have the same fundamental problem. This is John's point in the text Janet read, and the point, I hope, of the sermon, that you and I share our most profound, our deepest need, and our most pressing, most urgent need, and that is to know God. Whatever else you need, however legitimate your other needs are, your most important need is to know God. When I say to know God, I don't mean know about him, know data regarding him, right? I know about Abraham Lincoln, that he was tall and from Illinois and the 16th president. But I know Vanessa, my wife, in an entirely different way. And it's that second way of knowing that is what we need when it comes to God. Not to know him like a blurb in a history book, to know him like a spouse, like a friend. There's a logic to that, right? We all intuitively understand the value of close relationships, of intimacy, of knowing and being known. And if it's possible to have a relationship with God, it stands to reason that that would be the most important, the most valuable and intimate and life-giving of all. And even so, even if you track with that logic, my guess is that there are very few people in the room who spent most of the last week burning with the desire to know God better. The complicatedness of life tends to crowd that out. And instead of striving to know God better, we find ourselves worrying about our other problems. And they're legitimate. Maybe you watch the news, and as we get into primary season again already, you find yourself spending energy on, is our national politics ever going to get better? Will we ever stop squabbling and start trying to figure out what to do about climate change or the disintegration of the family or 100 other important things? Or take it from politics to personal. How are we going to get through Christmas dinner without just killing one another? How am I ever going to get out of debt? What am I going to do with myself once I retire? And those are just the kind of weighty sounding questions. If we're going to really capture human experience, you got to include the other stuff, right? The things that occupy our attention just as much. How many likes did my latest post get? How am I going to make it through that 3-hour meeting without dying of boredom? Will the Beavers ever have a good football team? And by far the most stressful question in my home on a daily basis, who is going to feed all of these children? That's human life, right? So how are we supposed to carve out the time and mental space to know God? Who's going to manage that? I want you to understand that when I say that your deepest and most important need is to know God, I'm not saying that that's your only need. I'm not saying that what you need to do is abandon ordinary life and go become a monk on a mountaintop. I'm saying rather that your life needs to be reordered around knowing God. That in the constellation of your needs, knowing God needs to be the anchor point. And that's only possible if God makes himself known. I mean, in any relationship, you can know facts about me without my trying to reveal them to you, but you can't know me unless I decide to open myself up to you. And the same is true of God. You can only know him if he makes himself known. And John, when he writes as a Jew in the midst of a Jewish community, and every good Jew knew that, thankfully, God had already made himself known. And the way he had done that was through what's called the law, or the Torah. And John acknowledges this, right, in verse 17. The law was given through Moses. He's referring to this long conversation God and Moses had about 1,500 years before John, in which God laid out in great detail how he wanted his people to live. And it was understood that God wasn't only saying, this is how I want you to live. He was also saying, this is who I am. I'm giving you the law as a way to know me. And that's true of the big commandments, right? Do not murder doesn't just tell us not to kill one another. It also tells us that God is life-giving and life-honoring. Remember, the Sabbath doesn't just stop us from doing certain things on Sundays. It tells us that God is no taskmaster. That he's going to provide for us even when we rest. Even the weird stuff reveals who God is. You know, you may be aware there's roughly 150 million laws about what you can and can't eat in the Torah. And if you read through them, at least my eyes glaze over and I have no idea what's going on, right? But what God is actually showing us there is who he is, that he's a God who's involved in your ordinary life. In breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And he's a God who's distinct from every other thing you might worship, and he wants you to be visibly distinct from the people around you who just eat thoughtlessly without regard for what they're doing. The law shows us who God is. Every bit of the law is, it's sort of like God's autobiography, him describing his nature to us. And if you want to get to know somebody, reading an autobiography is a great place to start. John, he knows this and he wants to draw on this heritage. So in verses 14 to 18, he's showing us that Jesus functions in the same way that Moses does. That just like the law, Jesus makes God known. He reveals God's character. And so what I want to do, this is going to take a while, but we're going to kind of spend time in verse 14. And I want you to see that verse 14, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen His glory. Glory is of the only Son of the Father, full of grace and truth. That is not just a profound bit of theological poetry, but that John has deliberately structured that verse to map onto a specific part of the law, a specific part of the conversation God had with Moses to reveal Himself. And that this verse is meant to map onto relationship dynamics, what it is to know and be known. So in this verse, John's going to draw on Exodus and on our everyday experience to show us that just as with Moses, Jesus is revealing God's presence and worth and character. So, if you've got your Bible, keep a finger in John 1, but flip back to Exodus chapter 33. If you grab one of those hardback black Bibles in the pews, that's on page 73. In Exodus, God and Moses, they're in the midst of their long conversation in which God's revealing Himself, and this question of just how close Moses and the rest of God's people can be to God, just how well they can know Him, is at issue. And so first what comes up is God's presence. Is God going to be present with His people? I'm picking it up in Exodus chapter 33, verse 12. Moses said to the Lord, "See, you say to me, bring up this people, but you have not let me know whom you will send with me." And then go down to verse 14. "And God said, my presence will go with you, and I will give you rest. And Moses said to him, if your presence will not go with me, do not bring us up from here. If we don't have your presence, then we can't know you, and there's no point." And John draws on this when he opens verse 14, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." And God became a human being in order to be present with us. Presence is the foundation of any good relationship, yes? Before we were married, Vanessa and I lived 800 miles apart for the first 2 years of our relationship. And so every few weeks I would fly to North Carolina, from North Carolina to Mississippi, to spend a couple of days with her, to be present with her. And in between, pretty much my entire life was thinking about being present with her. I would sit in class, ignoring whatever it was I was supposed to be learning and counting down, right? Okay, it's only 316 and a half more hours until I land in Mississippi and can see her and be present with her again. That presence was the heartbeat, the foundation. That was what kept our relationship going. It's what keeps any really good relationship going. And Moses knows this, and so he asks it of God, "Will you be present with us?" And John draws on that to say, in Jesus, the answer is yes. God will be present with you. It will be possible for you to know Him. So that's presence. The next piece that comes up here is worth. John continues in verse 14, "And we have seen His glory." Glory is of the only Son from the Father. That word glory, it means weight or value or worth. It means how important something is. Right? When the first time that I went to visit Vanessa, spend a weekend with her, by the time the visit was over, I had decided I wanted to marry her. Which meant I had decided she was worth it. Her worth was such that it made sense to keep buying plane tickets. It made sense to save up and purchase the world's tiniest diamond because that's what I could afford on a dishwasher salary. Right? It still took like 300 hours of labor to buy that diamond. Right? It was worth almost flunking out of school because I was working so many hours at the dining hall washing dishes. I began to understand her worth, her value, her glory. I began to grasp that she really was worth more than money, than time, than grades, than all the other possible futures that I could have had without her. I was getting a sense of her value. John says that we get a heightened sense of that through Jesus. Right? He says, and in Jesus we see God's glory, and then he says we see it at the glory as of the only Son of the Father. And that word only is monogenes in Greek, which means something like a species of one. Right? You might recognize genus from biology and mono, one. There's only one of him. Jesus is not an extraordinary example of a human being. He's not like anyone or anything else. It's just him, and his glory is the same. His glory can't be measured against other glories. There's no ratio. There's no exchange rate. I mean, how many nuggets of gold would it take to equal the worth of the person who invented gold itself? How many moments of happiness would you need to have to be able to trade for him who is the author of all joy and happiness? God's glory, his worth, is off the scale. It is one of a kind, transcendent and unique. And Moses, he has some sense of this. And so as soon as he secures God's promise to be present, the next thing he wants is an understanding of God's glory so that he can know him better. Look at verse 17. And the Lord said to Moses, "This very thing that you have spoken I will do. I will be present with you. For you have found favor in my sight, and I know you by name." And then Moses said, "Please, show me your glory. Please show me your glory. I need to see you. I need to understand more and more your worth. I need it to become more and more clear to me that it makes perfect sense to sacrifice time, to sacrifice money, to flunk out of school, to give up all other possible future lives that I could live apart from you in order that I would know you. Please help me understand how valuable you are." So, first, presence, and then worth. Third is character. Third is character. Verse 14 in John ends, "full of grace and truth." And grace and truth are, they're two different words that I'm not going to get into a lot of the details, but they refer to God's commitment to our well-being. His sort of no holds barred, no caveat, no catch, "I am going to be for you-ness." That's grace and truth. And John doesn't pull those words out of a hat. He takes them from Moses, from the beginning of Exodus chapter 34, as this conversation continues. And in this passage, God tells Moses his full name, which he's never done before for anyone else. And you need to know that in the Bible, names aren't just names. Names define people. Names reveal a person's character, their nature. And so it is with God. So when God tells Moses his name, he's announcing what his character is. This is Exodus 34, verses 5, 6, and 7. "The Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before Moses and proclaimed, 'The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children, to the third and fourth generation.'" That's God's name. That's God's character. And John knows it, and so he repeats it. That phrase in verse 14, "full of grace and truth," is the translation of the phrase at the end of Exodus 34, 6, "abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness." Jesus isn't revealing something new, something out of left field about God. He's revealing God's name, God's character, which God told Moses all those years ago. There's a new depth to it, right? I know Vanessa, 12 years into marriage, much, much better than I knew her when I was flying back and forth across the Southeast. But I haven't made eureka discoveries, you know, like whole uncharted areas of her character that I didn't know anything about. What's happened is a deepening of the sort of elementary knowledge that was established at the beginning. And that will continue. I mean, maybe there are huge surprises left. She's looking at me like maybe she's been holding out. But I'll be surprised. Duh. What I should expect is that as more years go by, that character will be more revealed to me in the depth of it, in the weight, in the value and worth of it. And that's what Jesus is offering. So, Jesus reveals God's presence and worth and character. As God revealed his presence and worth and character to Moses many years before, and as any relationship requires. So I've shown you so far, I hope, that Jesus kind of parallels Moses. But John actually claims much more than that. John isn't claiming that Jesus is another Moses. John's claiming that Jesus surpasses Moses, that he provides a better way to know God than the law did. That verse 16, where it says, "And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace," the fullness of Jesus, we have all received grace upon grace. The language there, grace upon grace, it means grace replacing grace. Or even grace surpassing grace. The grace, the gift of the law was real and good. And now Jesus has come along and surpassed it. Yes, the law was God's autobiography, and you can know God to some degree through reading it. But Jesus is God made flesh and dwelling among us. And if you want to know someone and you have a choice between their autobiography and their real presence, you choose the presence every time. There's nothing inherently broken in the law. You could think of the law as being like an excellent trail guidebook if you're a hiker, but Jesus is the actual hike. The law may be a preview, but Jesus is the feature-length masterpiece. He goes beyond the law in making God known. There's a number of other clues to make that clear, that that's what John's driving at in the paragraph, and I'm not going to get into all of them. I would love to have you come up and ask me about them, and I'll just nerd out with you for a while later, but we're going to keep moving. And we're going to talk about how it is that Jesus surpasses the law, how it is that he supersedes and moves beyond the law. And to do that, we have to start back in Exodus with God's name. You'll notice God reveals his name in two verses, verses 6 and 7, but verses 6 and 7 don't necessarily sound the same. Okay? Verse 6. "The Lord passed before Moses and proclaimed, 'The Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness.'" That God is so nice in verse 6. It's like your pal, your favorite grandpa. And it keeps going a little bit into verse 7, "keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and the fourth generation." That doesn't sound so nice. Now, the natural way to read that is that God is for the good people and against the bad people. If you're one of the good guys, then God will be merciful and gracious and slow to anger and abounding and so on and so forth. But if you're one of the bad guys, that would be the natural way to read it, except this whole conversation between God and Moses is taking place in response to the people of God committing notorious and grotesque sin. This is the second half of the golden calf story, if you know the book of Exodus, in which even though God had shown that he was full of grace and truth by bringing his people out of slavery and by providing for them miraculously in the desert, they didn't respond with grace and truth at all. They responded by turning their backs on him. running from him and doing their own thing, behaving as if other things were far more important than he was. And here comes God saying, I am absolutely without reservation committed to your welfare, and I will never let sin go. How can God say that? How can he hate sin and love sinners? This is the defining question of the Bible. From Adam and Eve at the very beginning all the way up through Jesus. How can God be both of these things? Both just and the justifier of those who have gone astray. And God gives Moses kind of half of an answer, a stopgap, a sort of temporary compromise. Right after this story in the book of Exodus, God starts describing to Moses how to build something called the tabernacle, which was this elaborate tent, and the idea was that God's presence would still go with his people, God had promised, but the presence would be hidden inside of the tent. And only once a year could one representative of the people go into that tent for a little while if they did a bunch of other stuff right beforehand. It was like God was declaring a cold war between his sense of mercy and his sense of justice. And they were going to be standing off against one another indefinitely. I want you to imagine a husband whose wife has cheated on him. Just like the Israelites did with the golden calf, cheating on God. Just like you and I do all the time when we treat other things as more important than he who made all things. What are the husband's options? Well, he could divorce his wife. He could end the relationship. And that would satisfy justice, right? She's already effectively severed the marriage bond by choosing somebody else over him. So that would be an option. On the other hand, he could try to just look past it, forget what happened, and move forward. That would preserve the image, the veneer of the relationship. But it wouldn't save the real thing. We all know that underneath the surface, distance and discontent would be festering. You know, like sewers that are overfull and threatening to back up at any moment. It might appear merciful to do that, but it wouldn't save the relationship at all. With Moses, God seems to kind of try to weave his way in between the two. It's like the husband said, okay, look, you can still live here, but you're moving into the guest room. That's really the very closest I can stand for you to be. And that's the way it is for hundreds and hundreds of years until Jesus comes along. And Jesus reveals a new way. A new way for us to know God and a new way for God to respond to our adultery. It's hinted at the in the beginning of verse 7 in Exodus, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. Jesus comes to bring forgiveness. That's going to be the third way. And don't just hear that word and move on. Forgiveness does not mean, hey, it's no big deal. I know you mean well. Let's forget about it. Forgiveness means you hurt me, and I choose to pay the debt. A husband who forgave his cheating wife wouldn't stop feeling the pain of her betrayal, of her unfaithfulness at all. What he would do is feel that pain and then choose, day in and day out, not to give the pain back to her. Either in the form of a divorce or in the form of 1,000 paper cuts of resentment, but to absorb the pain himself. To swallow it, to pay the debt in full. That's how Jesus brings forgiveness to us, by himself shouldering the pain of our betrayal. And that satisfies God's justice because sin is not ignored or painted over, but dealt with and confronted. And it satisfies God's mercy because it allows him to continue loving sinners like you and me. But because God is no ordinary husband, but the one and only author and source of life, the penalty for divorcing him is not just life without him, but the end of life. And so in order to take on the full force of our betrayal, Jesus has to die in our place. That's the fullness of God's grace and truth. That's the only place you can see just how far God is willing to go to have a relationship with you, to be known by you. He is so committed to your welfare that he would die in your place so that you could be forgiven. In this way, Jesus surpasses Moses. In this way, Jesus goes far, far, far beyond the law in making God known to us, in being God present with us, in displaying God's worth, his glory before us, in unveiling God's true character, the depth of his justice and his mercy, his love and his truth before our eyes. Of all the people you could have a relationship with, of everyone you could and should know, no one is better, and no one is more important than that. You need to know God more than you need anything else. I want to end by recognizing the patience that's embedded in this story, in this picture of God and of Jesus. If you have tracked with everything that I've talked about so far, and it's really hit home that your fundamental need is to know God, and that it's Jesus who makes God known to you, who makes it possible for you to have a relationship with him, let me tell you what's going to happen. You are going to get distracted. You are going to leave here and go back into your complicated life, full of all kinds of legitimate needs, some of which are whispering urgently in your ear and some of which are just bellowing at the top of their lungs and won't pause. And you're going to get distracted. No matter how good your intentions are, you're going to find yourself worried about other things. And I want you to see that that's an okay place to start. That if that's where you are, God will meet you even there. That's what God's people were doing in the golden calf episode. God and Moses are at the top of the mountain, and God's handing out his autobiography, and he's even issuing signed copies on the Ten Commandments. Right? And down at the bottom of the mountain, God's people are distracted. Their attention is wandered and they're focused on other things, but they stay God's people. God hates their sin, but continues to love them. And so it will be with you. My mom is here today, and she doesn't know that I'm about to do this. When our life began together, I didn't care a fig for knowing her. Right? I cared about getting my needs met. I wanted to eat, and I wanted to be walked in the snuggly every single minute that I wasn't eating. And she was the person who could feed me and then walk me around until her legs fell off. And that was fine with me. I wanted my needs met, and out of love, she met them. And for most of my life, that's been the basic dynamic, right? I have thought of her less as a person and more as an entity that either puts food on the table or makes me do chores. And over the course of my life, I have experienced her justice. I don't think there's anybody, any human being on earth who has ever been as angry at my sinful selfishness as my mother has. And apart from Vanessa, I don't think there's been any human being on earth who has demonstrated grace and truth to me to the degree that she has, whose love for me has abounded in steadfastness and in faithfulness. But it's only as an adult, after years and years of it being one way, that I've even begun to care to know her, to want to understand her as a person and draw close to her in the way she has always been drawing close to me. Valuing a person in a relationship for who they are and not for what they can do for you is a mature virtue. It takes years to cultivate in any relationship. And so it is in your relationship with God. If you listen to this and 24 hours from now you find yourself only anxious about your stuff, about your health or politics, or when are you going to get to see that friend you haven't seen in a while, know that God continues to be gracious to you. It is not the strength of your commitment, but of His that binds Him to you. It is not the steadfastness of your love, but the steadfastness of love He displayed on the cross that makes it possible for you to know Him. And so wherever you find yourself, however noisy and complicated and distracting your life is, know that you need to know God, and know that God will be patient as you come to know Him, that you may get distracted, but He never will be. Over the course of your lifetime, learn to know God better, because only in that will you learn that there is nothing better than knowing Him.